director of the OJRC. Bob, this was a tremendous conference. Congratulations, first of all. Tell me about the conference in a nutshell.
Well, the conference in a nutshell, what we wanted to do is create a space to be able to talk about issues affecting women in the criminal justice system. This conference has been going on for over a decade. It was hosted in Eugene and primarily put on by a University of Law professor who's now retired. When we heard about the conference, it was something that we were excited about and, you know, attended. And it wasn't that big, primarily for, I think, the law school community down there. And when she was retiring, we knew that this was an important conversation to continue and wanted to continue to host the conference and moved it up here to Portland, where we've been able to increase the attendance over the past 4 years and began to really have a diverse audience that includes a significant number of formerly incarcerated women, service providers, attorneys, practitioners, volunteers, that are able to come together, talk about issues that are directly impacting women who are intersecting with our criminal justice system.
It was incredibly moving, so many powerful, in talking to some of the people here attending, it's just been, it's heart-wrenching. I mean, it feels like sometimes the system is set up to make people fail. And the kinds of obstacles, and we hear complaints about two-thirds of people reoffending. With as much effort as the system puts into making people fail, it almost feels like getting one-third of people to not recidivate is against all odds. That's tremendous. If we would stop putting so many hurdles in place, but I'm the reporter, so I shouldn't be going on.
I think you're right. The system itself right now is designed to punish, overly incarcerate, and really, as we learned during the conference, the sentencing structures that exist here in Oregon between our mandatory minimum Measure 11, the mandatory like sentences like under Measure 57 for property and drug crimes, they really have a lot of ambiguity and broadness to them and cast a very wide net. I think the intent, at least as the public understood what these laws were supposed to be, were really to get people who are the worst of the worst, habitual criminal, people who habitually commit criminal activity, and to really, understand that there has to be some punishment mechanism in our society. I don't think the public ever really understood fully that this is how these laws and this is how our criminal justice system would be used and these laws would be deployed. So what you end up having is a system that over-criminalizes and criminalizes people more quickly than it does anything else. And then once you're caught in the system's really designed not to allow you to succeed. It's actually with tremendous effort and resources that's required to ensure that people don't reoffend, that people are stable, because in a sense, we're criminalizing poverty, we're criminalizing those that are on the margin, and then when they get out, we prevent them from being able to access the things that they need in order to be stable, which is not things that the criminal justice system is supposed to provide, like mental health support, substance abuse or addiction support, counseling, family support, family reunification, connection type of things. So the criminal justice system, as it's designed, and sort of the sentencing options that exist here, it's very much being used with intention to basically brutalize segments of our community. And, it's not a system in the sense that it's a functioning system or one that's somehow a uniform system or a cohesive system. It's a bunch of specific actors that are working in silos that are churning people out in and out of our justice system.
Building awareness is hugely important. Getting the stories of these people out is hugely important. But moving forward, what more can we do to actually make these things change?
Yeah, a large part of it right now is a public education effort. I mean, I think sort of pulling back the curtain and taking a closer and deeper examination and look at the criminal justice system here in Oregon. In Oregon, we face kind of this unique aspect of our culture where we think that we're different, we're progressive, that we're somehow distinct from other states. And we don't do really any critical examination of our justice system. And so that's really going to be the first step, is to you know, look at what we're doing here. And when you do look at it more deeply, you'll see that we're not too dissimilar for some of the other states that we associate with bad incarceration policies that, you know, we normally think of, like the South, Louisiana, Texas, Florida. But if you really look at our system, there are components of our system that we've actually adopted from those states. We're not like one state, but we are like a hodgepodge of these southern states or these pro-incarceral states. And it's existing right here in Oregon. And in the way in which we're treating individuals and how we're criminalizing people, how we incarcerate them. And I think what we need to do is, in addition to public education, begin to really push back against those stakeholders and those system stakeholders that really have sort of perpetuated and thrived off of a fear and anger sort of politic or rhetoric that's helped sustain their own profession. So most namely the district attorney and district attorneys across the state. You'll notice many of them currently use that fear-based rhetoric in order to, you know, propagate or sustain these, you know, mandatory minimum laws that don't make any sense. I mean, one of the statistics that we saw here this weekend or learned about was arrest rates for women are down, crime rates are at all-time low, but our incarceration rates for women are higher. The only thing I can think of that is driving that is that the charging practices of prosecutors have changed dramatically, and they have become more aggressive in their charging practices, and this is why we have more felonies, and we're criminalizing behavior that a decade ago wouldn't have been criminal or wouldn't have been resulted in a prison sentence. And so we have to really start, you know, holding these stakeholders accountable and calling them out on this, on the rhetoric that they're using, and say, you know, the reality that they live in or the rhetoric that they're, you know, using is no longer connected to the society that we live in.
Bobbin, thank you so much for all of this and for all your time. Where can people find out more? What's your website, that kind of thing?
The Oregon Justice Resource Center's website is ojrc.org. We also have a social media presence, so you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and that's all straight through our website. You can look at it. And we are regularly updating our social media on a regular basis, so it's a good way to follow us. We also have a newsletter that people can sign up to through our website, and we send out about a monthly email news blast for folks. Not too often. When we do have events, we tend to, you know, email more often. But yeah, you can find all our information at our website, ojrc.org.
I've been speaking again with Bobbin Singh, Executive Director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Bobbin, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for being here and reporting on this.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
My name is Cassia Rutledge, and I'm a public defender with Metropolitan Public Defenders.
Cassia, you were just presenting here at the Women in Prison Conference Oregon Justice Resource Center is doing.
I was speaking about the shift in Oregon sentencing law from indeterminate sentencing to determinate sentencing based on a sentencing guidelines to complete removal of power and control from judges' hands and replacing it into the hands of district attorneys by means of Measure 11, which is mandatory minimum sentencing for certain crimes that requires an individual who's convicted of those crimes to serve every single day of their sentence without any time reduction, treats juveniles age 15 and older as adults, and gives all of the power to get a person out of Measure 11 into the hands of the district attorney alone.
Now, in addition to these mandatory minimums, that's pretty straightforward, this is the crime, you also displayed a rather complicated table showing it's basically a sentencing guidelines points. Could you just boil down especially what is the intersection of the mandatory minimums plus these guidelines?
Yes. So if you are accused of a felony in Oregon, then the judiciary, the judges, determine your sentence based on finding where you live on a grid. And the calculus that's done is looking at the seriousness of the crime that is on kind of the left side of the grid, running from 1 being a low-level crime and 11 being a very serious crime. And at the top of the grid is your prior criminal history. That includes both juvenile adjudications as well as adult convictions. So determinate sentencing and sentencing guidelines tell judges which box you belong in, and the box is either filled with a month in prison or a basically a probation sentence with the amount of jail time that you can do. Measure 11 and other mandatory minimum sentencing takes you out of that grid, off of that grid, where judges have some discretion in terms of what to give you, probation versus prison, and how much time to give you, and requires that they give you a set determined number of months in prison starting at 70, going up to 300.
Now, some of the examples you were giving of Measure 11 crimes, things that would actually create these long mandatories, we get the impression, just like the Kingpin statutes, we get the impression it's going to be someone who's just a huge criminal and doing all kinds of stuff. In the real world, what do these crimes catch?
So, for example, robbery in the second degree is one of the most commonly charged Measure 11 crimes, and it's one of the most commonly charged Measure 11 crimes for juveniles, so 15 and up. And what Measure 11 Rob 2 looks like is a person or a group of people go to Fred Meyer's during their lunch break from school, say they're 16, 17, one or more of them shoplift a candy bar, bag of chips. And as they're walking out of the store, loss prevention or store security grabs them and says, hey, stop. And they pull away from them, shove them, try and hold on to their bag or the bag of chips they've stolen. That is a robbery in the second degree punishable by 70 months mandatory because it is stealing something, using or threatening to use force, and having other people aid you that are actually present. So the number one crime I represent juveniles on for Measure 11 is that Rob 2, and they're looking at a mandatory 70 months if convicted.
And what you described is that's shoplifting.
It's shoplifting plus a push is what we call it.
I'm curious, if the person didn't react like any normal person would when someone grabs them by the shoulder, if they had just stood there stock still, would they have a shoplifting charge, and how long would they even see the inside of a jail cell?
Yeah, if somebody is just stopped by a loss prevention officer and either immediately hands over the stuff or drops the things or doesn't pull away, then that's not robbery, it's theft, and it is determined by the value of what you've stolen. So the candy bar incident would be a theft 3. You'd do some community service and have a C misdemeanor on your record if convicted. But pulling away with a candy bar in your pocket makes it a felony punishable by a mandatory minimum.
So tell me about some of the work that you do at Metropolitan Defenders.
So I've been there for about a little over 8.5 years now. I'm in the major felony unit, so I represent almost exclusively people charged with Measure 11 crimes. And we take every type of case that we're assigned when they come in. We work with our clients to prepare the best defense we can, develop mitigation, work to try and get them the best plea offer they want, if that's what we end up going down, the path we end up going down, or try and defend them the best we can at a trial.
Do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners? And where do people find out more about Measure 11 and in that?
So some closing thoughts is that I think that Measure 11 was passed in 1994 by a voter initiative under the misperception that crime was increasing, particularly violent crime was increasing, and that even if that was true, that the best result was to, or the best way of enacting it, was to throw more people away for longer without giving judges any discretion in understanding how we got to where we were, to where we are, and what the best course of action is. And fundamentally what it does is it shifts the power from judges, as well as from defense attorneys and victims of crime and families of those people, to say what they think should happen, and gives it all to district attorneys who have very limited accountability and very limited ability to be responsive to the population.
Gotcha. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kboo.org.
Join me Friday, October 21st from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. for From the Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and political commentary. On Friday, October 21st, we will continue with P-Funk and politics, where fantasy is reality. On 90.7 FM, KBOO.
Fantasy is reality in the world today. I'll keep hanging in there. That's the only way.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rent's Tents Development. Who does the City Council represent on Friday, October 21st at Revolution Hall in Portland? Rents, Tents, and Development is an election debate featuring candidates for Portland City Commissioner Chloe Udaly and Steve Novick. This event will focus on how housing intersects with other social justice causes and the candidates' vision of how we can take local action to change housing policy in our city. Again, that's Rents, Tents, Development. Who does City Council represent on Friday, October 21st at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland? More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you,